This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. February 29th marks Rare Disease Day. The date was chosen fittingly because February 29th is, of course, a rare day. It became annually observed worldwide on the last day of every February. Consultant pediatrician and clinical geneticist Dr. Tong Miao Kiong, who is also advisor to the Malaysian Rare Disorder Society, gives us more details. Welcome to the show, Dr. Tong.
Thank you very much.
How do we define a rare disease?
Okay, rare disorders is basically defined as a medical condition that is not commonly found in the population. There are various definitions for that. In the European Union, it's defined as 1 in 2,000 persons. In the USA, it's a condition that's found in less than 200,000 people in their entire country. In Malaysia, we do not have an official definition. However, the Malaysian Rare Disorder Society has empirically taken a ratio of 1 in 4,000 population.
And where do these rare diseases usually originate from? How do they originate? Is it because of genetics? Is it environment?
Yeah, in the early years, not much was known about rare diseases, so there's not much information. But in the last couple of years, 10 years or so, with the advent of genetics and genomics information, close to 80% of the rare disorders are thought to be mainly due to genetic or genetic predisposition, and the rest could be due to some environmental factors.
What are the challenges in accurately diagnosing a rare disease, considering that they are, you know, by their nature rare, firstly, and secondly, that I don't believe a specialist would often be the first person, the first point of contact. It would normally be a primary care physician.
Yes, it's always a difficult task to diagnose a rare diseases. Very often, the patient starts on what we call a diagnostic odyssey. They're often seen their family doctors who may or may not make a diagnosis. Very often, there was no diagnosis made. And if the condition deteriorates, very often the patient might be seen in the hospital. And then certain tests might be done, and the results might be inconclusive or non-diagnostic. And then the patient might decide to stop searching for the answer. Very often for children, the parents are more concerned, and they would actually seek out more information, perhaps online or on the internet. Sometimes they might go and see a geneticist, for example, and the condition may be made at that point in time. Now, having said that, perhaps up to 50% of these rare disorders remain undiagnosed, even quite extensive testing. And therein lies their difficulties, because unlike other medical conditions where there's a name, very often a rare condition either have a very long name or they have no name at all, and therefore it sort of gives rise to a range of issues.
What differentiates, you know, a rare disease with no name, you know, something that you're not sure about, from something that you're just going to say is idiopathic, for example?
Yeah. So when you have a condition with a name, it helps a lot. It helps the patients. It helps the parents or the child who is affected, because now they can focus on therapy, treatment, rehabilitation, and also planning the future and the family. For those who, unfortunately, who still do not have a diagnosis, they either remain on this diagnostic odyssey, or sometimes they learn to live with this condition without a name. Very often I tell them that even though a condition may not have a name, there are still treatment that can be given to a child or a person, depending on the condition or dysfunction that the person may have resulting from that condition. So it is not entirely hopeless. It is still doable, and we can still help them.
That process that you described earlier, you know, of deterioration, of finally, you know, kind of seeing a specialist that might be able to help you and so on, are rare diseases ever diagnosed in utero so that you can kind of skip all this and hopefully start treatment, you know, hit the ground running?
Yeah. Very often now, parents, they want to know, even before the pregnancy itself, whether there are any risk involved in having a baby. And very often, the condition might be diagnosed by the obstetrician during pregnancy due to a number of genomics testing that are available nowadays. Very often, the results may not be conclusive, as the result that is available may take a long time to come back. So the issue is getting more complex because the parents are getting some of these rare disorders diagnosed. But the implication for the child is that we may not know the severity of the condition, for example. And therefore, it is important that this family receive some form of genetic counseling on that particular condition before they make any definitive decision.
Does Malaysia right now have the necessary technology for diagnosing rare diseases, particularly genetic disorders?
Rare disorders basically are diagnosed by a variety of ways. You can do a clinical assessment, meaning you take a good history, and very important, take a good family tree, and then we do a thorough examination. And very often, we can narrow it down to a couple of conditions. And then we may subject the patient to some tests. Some of these tests are quite basic, for example, a chromosome study or some kind of metabolic studies, before we proceed on to the next phase of more complex genetic testing. And some of these tests that are recently available include things like microarray chromosomal analysis or genomic sequencing, but those tests are expensive and they do not often provide the answers. And therefore, the current recommendation is all this genetic and genomic testing should be preceded by some kind of genetic counseling before they are done.
On that note about counseling, based on your experience, how do parents usually receive a diagnosis of rare disease?
Usually, the diagnosis might be made after all these tests that we do. We usually call this a result disclosure session. So they would have received counseling before the test. And after the test results are available, we do what we call a post-test counseling. A post-test counseling basically going back to the basic sciences, some explanation about the test. And we prepare the parents or the clients or the patients for the results. And we try our best to break the information to them in terms, in words which they can understand. And very often we provide a support, or sometimes they may request for further testing to confirm the diagnosis that's been given. A very important aspect of this counseling is that we need to provide support for the family, helping them to cope with the bad news and to cope with the loss which they are feeling at the moment.
When we talk about having to live with this illness and, you know, having to cope with it, is it often chronic conditions? I assume that there are very few cures in sight.
Yes. In the past, very few of them had any kind of cure. But now we're talking about holistic care. Holistic care involves not just a specific pill or surgery, but it is also in terms of support, rehabilitation, maximizing the potential of the person, improving the quality of life. So the overall concept of care has changed from just treatment of the condition per se to encompass a bigger picture, including therapy for the family and so on. Now, we do understand that rare diseases, being rare, do not get as much attention from the pharmaceutical companies in the past for obvious reasons. For example, if the number of patients are small, it is unlikely they might recoup their investment, or they do not see any benefit to a business to market the drug. In the past years, there are moves, for example, in the USA and the EU to have legislation, for example, the Orphan Drug Act, that would give leeway to pharmaceutical companies who would want to develop therapy for rare disorders by giving them exemptions. And the FDA, for example, might not apply the same stringent requirements that would normally would have been applied to a normal pharmaceutical product. So we call this an orphan drug because they would expedite the production, cut down the costs, and make it available to the patients that are few in numbers. Despite that, however, the cost of production of these drugs are still sky high. So the end product are relatively still very expensive, particularly for middle-income or low-income countries.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Thong Miao Keong, consultant pediatrician and clinical geneticist, and advisor to the Malaysian Rare Disorder Society. He's here because we're talking about Rare Disease Day 2016, specifically how rare disorders are reflected here in our country. Up next, we find out the kinds of rare disorders that Dr. Thong has encountered in his career. You're listening today to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You're listening to Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and today we are speaking with Dr. Thong Miao Keong, consultant pediatrician and clinical geneticist, as well as advisor to the Malaysian Rare Disorder Society. And we're talking about rare disorders in conjunction with Rare Disease Day 2016. Now, what are some of the examples of rare disorders that you've encountered here in Malaysia during your medical career?
Well, if you look at the textbook, there were at least 7,000 minimum types of rare diseases. Depending on the population that we serve, certain rare diseases are more prevalent in that particular subpopulation. In Malaysia, for example, some of these rare conditions that we meet can range from bone diseases. Example of it is called osteogenesis imperfecta, where a child might have brittle bone diseases, or they may have a muscle disorder, for example, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, which affect the boys, and they usually have very poor muscle development, resulting in various handicap. We have inherited enzyme defects, disorders, for example, and when you are short of an enzyme that works, you might accumulate certain toxic products in your body. Example of that is lysosomal storage disease. And of course, there are various neurological conditions that affect the muscles, the nerves, and the brain. And they all are seen in, for example, in the genetic service in the hospital where I work.
Are any of these disorders of particular interest to you? Are they of any sort of research interest?
Yeah, when we first started out, we looked at the most common rare disease way back 20 years ago, and that was a condition called beta thalassemia major. And in fact, one of the first discoveries we made was to understand how common was it. So it was a rare condition that became a common condition relatively. And we not only helped to understand it better in Malaysia, we also found that, for example, among the Sabahan, the Kadazan Dusun population had the highest incidence of beta thalassemia major in the whole of the country. And of course, the rest of them was history, because following the work that we had done, much help has been made available to this group of patients, including safe blood transfusion, iron chelation therapy, support for the family, and so on. So a lot of education program has gone into that. Now, we are embarking into the other phases where other rare diseases would require an equal, if not more, attention from the health professionals to raise our awareness among the public, so that this group of patients get the help and attention they deserve.
The theme for this year's Rare Disease Day is patient voices, which is very fitting considering what you're talking about. But in your experience, how vocal are patients of rare disease or disorders in our country? You know, do they have a voice? Do they have a platform to speak?
Well, the voices among patients and their families had always been rather mute in the past. It could be due to the lack of education opportunities. But in the recent 15 years, for example, when we set up the first support group from rare diseases, so we call the Malaysian Rare Disorder Society, in 2004, we have seen progress been made in leaps and bounds. I suspect it's also that with these social media, internet, and various NGOs, including radio stations, who had taken a strong, keen interest in this. And I think it is it's a tribute to the people who have sacrificed much of the time and effort to go the extra mile. And we are now seeing students, whether in the secondary school or in the universities, taking an interest, organizing events, fundraisings for this group of patients. I think it has gone a long way. But we still need a large part of work done, and that is to get the message not just to the masses, but to the powers to be that make decisions that would make a difference to their lives.
The Malaysian Rare Disorder Society, does it provide a platform of sorts for patients to meet other patients, for families to talk to one another? Because I would imagine that they would be the best support system for one another.
Yeah, that's one of the main aim of a support group like the MRDS, and that is to provide a source of information that is reliable, to provide a platform or meeting place, whether virtual or whether it is in person. And we recognize sometimes it's difficult for parents to bring their kids from all over the country, like Malaysia, to meet. So they also communicate through WhatsApp and various online media to talk about their children's condition and to share practical things like how to care for a child in a day-to-day kind of thing. So I think they do make progress in that aspect, and I think much more can be done in the long run for this.
Right now, who are key stakeholders that you feel need to hear the stories of patients and of caregivers and doctors who are working within this world of rare disorders?
Well, the key stakeholders are many. We need to bring all these support groups together. I'm glad to say there are now many, many support groups that have set up catering to various conditions. So first of all, there need to be an alliance of all these rare disorder society to come together to share information. And you'll be surprised to see how much they have in common. Secondly, they need to get the public involved. And then they need to get the professional and the healthcare professionals involved, because those are the frontliners. For example, family doctors need to be aware of this condition and to make an early referral to the appropriate expert to make a diagnosis. And then we need to engage the universities, which does training, education, and research. And finally, the government has a big role to play, not just the Ministry of Health, but also involving the Ministry of Women, Welfare and Community, and so on. All of them had to sit together. And in fact, the MRDS organized two previous national rare disease conferences, and they had made remarkable achievements and progress along the way.
What are the consequences of a lack of knowledge on rare diseases at a policy-making and diagnosis level? I mean, we talked about diagnosis earlier and how difficult that can be, both for doctors as well as families. But on a policy level?
Well, if there are no policies, for example, on orphan drug or rare disease, then it is unlikely that this group of patients will get financial support which they so deserve. There are ways to raise funds, for example, to crowdfunding and various other methods, but it is unlikely to raise the vast sums of money for treatment of a lifetime for a patient with rare diseases. So in all countries that I'm aware of, the government, for example, even in Taiwan, Australia, has enacted orphan drug acts so that it would give these patients short in life, and it would show that government is caring for the constituent, and also it shows that we have advanced as a nation and as a community.
When you talk about orphan drugs earlier, right now, are they available here?
Orphan drugs are available. They need to go through the usual process of being registered by the drug control authorities, and they are marketed. Unfortunately, they are very, very costly. In fact, the government is actually paying for some of the treatment of these patients. For example, I mentioned about thalassemia. And lately, for example, some of this enzyme replacement therapy that costs millions of dollars for a single patient a year. And the government has been very helpful. But more needs to be done, because there are more patients being detected, diagnosed, but unfortunately they do not get the help and the treatment they need.
Is enough research being done on rare diseases in our country?
Well, rare disorders are difficult to accumulate in sufficient numbers, and therefore we often do what we call a multi-center research. We get the cooperation of all groups of patients and also the health professionals, and therefore there's a need to set up a rare disease registry in Malaysia, which currently do not exist. A registry will be very helpful because it will form a centralized database of all the patients in Malaysia. And this would go a long way to getting the data and the information that we need. We have done so for thalassemia, and I don't see any reason why this should not work for rare disease as well.
What kind of public health policies do we have at this moment that address rare disorders?
Now, for public health policies, there are a number of programs that we can undertake. For example, to reduce the incidence of rare diseases caused by infectious agents. For example, in the past, we have rubella. But by giving vaccination to our population, the children with rubella vaccination, for example, had helped this condition called congenital rubella syndrome. In other countries, they had advised women of childbearing age to take folic acid 400 microgram at least 1 month before conception, going on through the first 2 months of pregnancy to reduce 70% of neural tube defects, or what we call spina bifida. And also, in many countries, they advocated a family tree initiative or family history initiative. For example, the CDC in the USA said this is a frontline assessment or the tool in the genomics age to assess the genetic risk for rare disorders to happen in your family by simply taking a good, thorough family tree. Yes, so there are quite a number of steps like that in the public health domain that can be used in Malaysia to reduce rare disorders.
Are there enough specialists to start putting that in place? Because I think that, as you say, in other countries, they might have more doctors, you know, to put it simply, who will be able to carry out these programs.
Yeah. Unfortunately, in Malaysia, rare diseases are usually diagnosed by pediatricians, particularly those who have strong interest in genetics. And from the genetics point of view, we started with just two clinical geneticists 20 years ago. Now we have a dozen clinical geneticists. We still need genetic counselors. We still need a lot more because as our population grows and awareness increases, the demand for services of diagnosing a person with rare disorders has now taken a new dimension, because our role now is just not making a diagnosis, but providing the support and the long-term care for this patient. So for those new young doctors, this is a green field for you to go into to take up clinical or medical genetics. Lots of scope and lots of work to be done.
I want to return briefly to that point about money, because it's clearly a major one, especially for patients. And earlier you talked about how the government has been generous in terms of its sponsorships. Does it also sponsor early intervention programs? And are these programs in general widely available?
Well, the government provides early intervention program to its various early schooling assessment and also providing rehabilitation services in the hospital. But I must say that because of the sheer number of people who need this kind of care and services, it's not sufficient, particularly in those who are underserved in the rural areas or in the urban poor. And even among those who can afford it, it is beyond the scope of many of middle-class families to engage rehabilitation services such as physiotherapy and speech therapy. Even early intervention program like early education for these children are not there. Very often, these families also need respite care because looking after a handicapped child is a 24/7 job. And very often, they need a break. The family need to have family time, sibling time. And so there are lots more work that need to be looked at in this aspect.
How does our society usually perceive patients with rare disorders as well as their families?
I would say that this attitude has changed quite a fair bit. And I'm glad to say that people are much more understanding and less judgmental. The stigma of having a rare disease remains, but I see hope at the end, light at the end of the tunnel. People are beginning to engage more, particularly the young and the school-going students, and this is a very good sign. However, lots more needs to be done to remove the stigma and to make sure that families who had a child who is handicapped with rare disease to come forward to get the help which they need.
Dr. Thong, before I let you go, I just wanted to kind of bring up something that I've noticed we've been doing. I keep calling it rare disease. I keep asking you about rare diseases. And when you answer me, you answer with rare disorders. Is there a difference? Am I using the word incorrectly?
Yes, that's a good question. We don't see much difference in the two terms. Basically, disease and disorders, from the medical point of view, they're the same. However, I prefer to remove some stigma by not saying the disease, because in the minds of some members of the public, a disease is something dreadful, something that had a negative connotation. The word disorders has been used by most rare disorders societies because they want to impart a feeling that, yes, there might be a disorder, but there is a chance to put things back in order. If you look at the various dictionaries, for example, they will say something similar. So, yes, not much difference, but there's a nuances of that.
Finally, how can people get involved in the upcoming Rare Disease Day?
Well, there are a number of ways, but you can contact the Malaysian Rare Disorder Society. They have a very active website. And I understand that this weekend, they are holding an exhibition, a photo exhibition of rare disorders patients organized by two rare disorder societies at the Empire Gallery in Subang Jaya. And I believe it will be officiated by the YB Hannah Yeo. So I think the members of the public are encouraged to visit them. The MRDS will be also co-organizing a charity run. They call it the Run the Rare Journey of Life at Taman Tasik Cempaka Bangi on the 28th of February, Sunday. So we have a number of activities lined up, and do check out their website for further information.
Thank you very much for coming in, Dr. Tong.
You're most welcome.
I've been speaking with Dr. Tong Miao Kiong, consultant pediatrician and clinical geneticist, as well as an advisor to the Malaysian Rare Disorder Society. Together, we've been discussing rare disorders in conjunction with the upcoming Rare Disease Day 2016. You've been listening today to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.